so it's a little bit different.
Hey guys, on this episode of Unbeatable, I get a chance to interview Adam Hill. And I like just about everything about this guy's story. The way that he's been able to overcome anxiety, the way that he's beat addiction, the way that he's been able to lead and to lead at the highest levels well. But more than anything else, what I love about this episode is Adam describing how key built a healthy relationship with fear. And on this episode, he shows you how you can do the same thing. So here is my guest for this episode of Unbeatable. Before we get into the conversation, I just want to remind you, I am facing a big change, and we're going to announce what that big change is. It's coming up soon. So stay tuned for future episodes when I tell you about a huge change coming in the future. Now here's my guest, Adam, on this episode of Unbeatable.
These stories of triumph over adversity will help you handle your toughest days in life and become unbeatable.
Hey, Adam, thanks for taking some time and being a guest on my podcast.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. This is awesome.
And when I say take some time, you're a really busy guy with a lot of irons in the fire. And the fact that you'd be willing to carve out a little bit of time for us to talk about all that you've done, how you've kind of transitioned your life and helping other people transition. It's not lost on me that you're, you know, giving up some valuable time for this today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And this is the fun part. Being able to be on here, I couldn't turn things like this down. This is exciting.
Well, I want to camp on the subject of fear today. And I'm a military guy. I have lots of military guests on this show who know a thing or two, actually more than a thing or two, about overcoming physical fear and the fear of, you know, combat and getting wounded or killed in action. But you've got a wealth of experience in the whole array of fears, meaning emotional and the whole, physical, as well as the fears that go along with transition and change and everything else like that. And these are one of my favorite subjects. So I am looking forward to having this conversation with you today, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
You're a guy who's, and I'm just going to shamelessly plug the book right out of the gate, who have shifted gears personally and gone from addiction and really, a health that was out of control to becoming, and this is my language, not yours, a poster boy for the Ironman Championships in Kona. I got to know, how did this transition happen for you, man?
Yeah, well, and thank you. Thank you for the intro. That's very kind. I grew up with a lot of fear, a lot of anxiety. I think it was just, it was one of those things where when I was a child, it was kind of my home just to be worried or anxious about things.
Really?
And yeah, it just felt like any kind of thing that would hit me from the outside would cause a sense of worry. I'd overthink it, or I'd have just too much. And I didn't put a lot of thought into why that was. I didn't think about that, and nobody really talked about it back then. It was the 80s, it was the 90s, and so we didn't talk about it. And in addition to that, I grew up in what would be considered a great family, two parents that loved each other, that loved us, that, you know, in a safe environment. We're talking about Orange County, California offline. I wasn't really exposed to a lot that would cause me fear. And that was an interesting perspective too, growing up, mentioning that you're a military man and other military people on this show who've experienced combat. I felt a lot of shame in my life for feeling fear when I shouldn't have had to, when other people, you know, comparing myself to other people who legitimately had a reason to feel that anxiety or fear. And so growing up, I kind of kept it to myself a lot. I started experiencing severe panic attacks in college. And it started when I was about 22 years old. I remember my first panic attack happened when I was studying for an exam. It was an organic chemistry exam. And yes, I can totally understand why that would cause.
Right, yeah. Now too, man, if you're talking organic chemistry, I'm nowhere. Right. There's no way I'm going to pass that test.
Right. Yeah. And I didn't pass the test, by the way, spoiler alert. But I remember when I was studying for that exam, I, I, I had this sense of like, you know, my chest tightened. I felt like I couldn't breathe. I collapsed onto the floor and I was just like, just sitting there, you know, almost in the fetal position, not able to concentrate on anything else, but this one just thought that was going through my mind that I had some horrible disease. And there was no reason for me to think that. I even knew that at the time, but it didn't stop the feelings from popping up, from the emotions and the physical sensations from happening and causing this panic attack that I didn't know what it was. And yeah, from that point forward, you know, it just evolved and I kept experiencing that. And of course, in the midst of that, during, you know, college, when many of us are in college and we go out and we experience independence for the first time, what do? We go out to party, we drink.
Uh-huh.
And I did that. And I found that when I drank, it lifted that anxiety from me. I became the life of the party. Sure. I was quote unquote normal. I could interact with people. And so there was this positive reinforcement that just kind of kept going. And then when I started experiencing the panic attacks, of course, then it became a medication for me to offset that. And then it became an every weekend sort of binge drinking thing. And then it became a blackout thing. And then it became an I can't control myself thing. And then it became a, you know, just this devastating back and forth of trying to white knuckle through most days and trying to function and then drinking myself into oblivion by night. And that was kind of the, I guess, the beginning act one of my life up until about my 30s. That's kind of, and for that decade between college and, you know, my early adult life, I was an active alcoholic and just trying to manage life, manage family, and do all of these things while drinking myself into alcoholism.
Yeah. This is fascinating because how old were you when you experienced this very first panic attack? You were still in college, but what age?
Yeah, I was about 21 years old. I remember okay. it was around the winter time, and I went to the University of California in Santa Barbara. A beautiful school, by the way, like, you know, wonderful place to be a college student. But yeah, still having these panic attacks, and again, feeling like I shouldn't be needing to feel this. Yeah. Everything's great, you know.
That's what's fascinating about this is I've seen some of the most fit, athletic, talented people, guys and gals on earth who are clutching their chest and they're in an ambulance on the way to the hospital. And when they get to the hospital, the doctors run all of the battery of tests and they literally say, there is nothing physically wrong with you. And anybody who's listening right now who has heard the phrase panic attack but never experienced it, I've never gone through it, but I've seen people going through it. It is mind-blowing how debilitating this can be. And there are millions of people tonight that are going to check themselves into hospitals all over the world mm-hmm. with something that's very wrong with them, and the doctors are going to run the test. And when the test results come back, they're going to hear there's absolutely nothing physically wrong with you. It is 100% stress, anxiety, or in your head.
Yeah.
And that's how serious, I'm just bringing this up right now because that's how serious the kind of anxiety, fear that you grew up with can be.
Yeah.
Even in your case, growing up in the 80s in Orange County, California, with a family that's, you know, mom and dad in the house and, you know, normal by most standards, doesn't insulate you from the fear of performance or whatever else it is. And I should point out to the audience, originally, alcohol was used as a medicine, right? It was a medicine to kind of deal with some emotional or psychological issues, to numb the pain a little bit, but also to loosen you up a little bit. And any medicine can be abused. I'm not just talking about, you know, the prescription painkillers out there, but anytime you start to use a medicine as an excuse for or to make up for a personal deficiency, you've crossed a line, even if it's not technically considered an addiction by most standards.
Yeah, yeah.
It sounds like by the time you're 30, it's for you a full-blown addiction. If you're blacking out and don't even remember how you got home kind of thing.
Right, yeah. It was definitely, it got that far pretty quick. And, you know, as with anything in our life, there's these seasons of kind of ups and downs. And I remember experiencing that with alcoholism. And that, of course, gave me the evidence I needed to keep drinking, which was like, well, yeah, I can keep somewhat control over this because there's times where I go without it and it's fine. And so there's, you know, you're building this story to support this insanity that I continued to live. And yeah, so throughout my 20s, it was me experiencing this anxiety and this panic, drinking and not being able to stop drinking once I started. And that was really the kind of alcoholic I was. It was one of those things where once I put the alcohol in my body, I couldn't stop doing it.
There's no way that this thing is going to end until you're passed out right on the floor somewhere, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's really difficult to explain that sensation to anybody that hasn't experienced it. And I myself never really knew what that was either, because I didn't grow up with alcoholism in my family. I guess I was a pioneer on that front, but
not the records you want to set.
No, definitely
in the family, right?
Right. But yeah, so when I got into my early 30s, I was working within, you know, our business, our family's business, and entry level stuff at the time. And at night and weekends, I was drinking to that was the time when I would drink. And during the week, I would basically try and white knuckle it through the week and function as a human being to keep the facade of that I was still operating, and all the while hiding it from almost everybody I knew, except my wife, who obviously knew. And then when I was 32, it came to a head. There were a lot of rules that I would set for myself again to prove that I wasn't a problem drinker. And I would say, like, don't drink before 5 p.m. Don't drink on weeknights. Don't, you know, things like that. It was, if you've ever seen the movie Gremlins, it's kind of like the rules for how to mogwai doesn't turn into a gremlin.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Don't expose into water. Don't get them around bright light. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
So I had this this non-negotiable rule. My non-negotiable was don't drink and drive, because I absolutely hated people who would drink and drive, who get behind
the wheel. Let me guess, this is the 90s, right? Where the whole world is being aware of, drunk driving and the tolls that it's taken, right?
Yeah. And this was actually 2012. So it was about, about 12 years ago. I born in 1979, grew up in the 80s and 90s. Finished college in the early 2000s, decade of alcoholism. So 32, 2012, I broke the last rule that I said that I would never break, which was drinking and driving. I got behind the wheel. I was blacked out and ended up getting into a DUI accident. And fortunately, nobody was hurt. Just by sheer luck and grace, whatever you want to call it. But I was in a jail cell that night, and the amount of despair and shame you can feel over doing something that, you know, you never
violating one of your own personal rules, right? Crossing one of your own lines that you said you'd never cross.
Breaking your values. I didn't know how to stop drinking at that time, and I didn't know how I could keep living on the planet if I couldn't stop drinking and be a harm to people. This was, I was okay with being a danger to myself, but not to others, and now I was that. That was obviously a very long night in a jail cell. And fortunately I made the decision not to end my life, which was on the table during that stay. But I chose to go into the rooms of recovery, which was Alcoholics Anonymous for me. And just take it a day at a time. I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous before this. I'd always thought to myself, well, but these are Hell's Angels,
these are losers that can't control it, right?
Right. They're guys who are sleeping behind dumpsters. I've got a job. Right. I've got a family. I got my shit together. Whatever. I apologize if I couldn't say that.
No, that's all right. Go for it, man.
But then I realized that I lost complete control of my life and that I had no power over alcohol. So
can I break in for just a second?
Sure.
Is it during that night in jail that you said, that's it, man, I'm going to AA?
Yeah. Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. It was my last drink was the one before I got behind the wheel. That was the last drink I've had since up to today. So I went into the room
since
of
2012.
AA. Yep.
Yeah. Yes. Way to go, man.
Thanks. Thank you.
Too bad that it took a DUI accident and a night in jail to get you there, but you're already answering for me one of the questions that I was dying to know. Mm-hmm. So I've had lots and lots of people from all walks of life on here that went through some really scary stuff, some really difficult stuff. And they usually describe the moments leading up to, I need to ask for help. And most of them, like you, like me, like most people on the planet, we will fool ourselves and lie to everyone around us saying, no, I'm good. I'm going to figure this out. I am strong enough. I'm smart enough that I could beat what millions of other people have not been able to beat. And then there's usually some cataclysmic event that causes people to say, I need help. I think part of real raw courage is getting to the point of admitting out loud, I need help, without that cataclysmic event. I mean, the cataclysmic event pushes you somewhere you don't want to go publicly, but the real courage is the guy or the gal that says, crap, I'm not as strong. I'm not as tough as I thought I am. I'm not beating this like I thought I could. I don't really want to do this out loud. I don't want to say these words out loud, but I'm going to tell a buddy I need help. And then from there, things start to fall into place.
Yes.
And I was dying to know, what was it that prompted you to say, okay, I'm not beating alcohol. It's beating me. I need help.
Yes.
But a night in jail will do that to you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I had that indication before. I mean, subconsciously there's, you know that you have a problem, and I just didn't know how to navigate. And selfishly, self-centeredly, I didn't want to be I didn't feel that community could help me. And I am so, I mean, it's just one of the things that I want to shout from the rooftops now, and why I want to share this story with people is because if I had embraced community earlier, I mean, if I had been there,
heck yeah.
I mean, the amount, I mean, since that date on 2012, which it was just a downward spiral up to that point and nothing but an upward spiral. I mean, obviously not a perfect linear.
Sure.
Yeah. But and yeah, that was that first moment for me. And yeah, thank God that I entered into that, because it was literally life or death at that moment.
I don't think I ever really considered until this part of your conversation, how isolating addiction becomes. Like, you start to let go of all of the relationships, or they become very surface level. All of the people in your life that really care about you would love to help you out of an addiction. The addiction starts to push those relationships towards the edges. And now it's just you and that addiction, whatever it is, pills or bottle or, you know, a million other things out there. And yeah, it never occurred to me until you're talking right now, the power of community, but addiction pulls you out of that community and keeps you alone and isolated. And you and I both know this from, you know, lots of real world example. Alone and isolated makes you a really, really easy target for that, you know, bottle again and again and again.
Yes, absolutely.
You grew up, I want to make sure that the audience understands, you grew up in a family and in an environment that you had a lot on the line when you were willing to come out publicly, especially if you're the first one in your family to ever do this. To struggle with an alcohol addiction and have to admit it out loud. You grew up in a family where there was a lot at stake here when you said, I need help. And a lot of, you know, attention and respect in the community, as well as, you know, your family's name. So let's come back to this part of the conversation, but let's detour for a second so that people learn a little bit about the hills Hill Brothers Chemical Company and the family that you grew up in. Can you give us a little bit of that backstory?
Yeah. So my my great-grandfather started the business in 1923 in Los Angeles, back when Los Angeles had something like 100,000 people living there, if you can imagine. I'm laughing. That.
101 years ago, there was about 100,000 people there. Yep. Now, there's 100,000 people that pass through the LAX airport every day.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it's and so I guess that's one of the first rules for success is start in a small town that will eventually become a giant city, metropolis.
Yeah. Well, just start in LA when it's 100,000 and right. Hang on for 100 years, inevitably you're going to be huge.
Yeah, absolutely. So, but yeah, my great grandfather started that business. He had a bicycle and a phone, and he just started brokering a business for, you know, laundromats at the time, with laundry chemicals and things like that. Uh-huh. Over time it evolved. His four sons came into the business.
That's where the brothers in Hill Brothers comes from, right?
Well, actually the brother, so he actually is originally started with his brother, but very shortly after, within the next few years, he actually bought out his brother and became his company, but the name stuck as Hill Brothers. But serendipitously, the four brothers in the next generation, the second generation, took over. And you know, that was there's an interesting kind of microcosm of the generations within a family business and how the world as a whole operates in generations. You know, that first generation, my great-grandfather started it pre-depression. So it was right in the midst of that economic boom.
Yeah, that's right. 23. Yeah. During the big boom of the 20s when everybody was making money hand over fist.
Yeah. Yeah. So he started that and worked through the depression and really, you know, got through that, and that shaped his mindset. You know, his kids' generation, which was the World War II, the greatest generation, mm-hmm. they took over and they ran the business the way that they did. They started expanding out into new territories. So we went into Arizona, we went into Northern California, and eventually Utah. And then, started selling more industrial environmental chemicals for water treatment, sewage treatment, and all sorts uh-huh. of different products that way. And then third generation, which was my father's generation.
Your parents' generation. Yep. Yeah.
So now we're in the cousins' generation, all of the cousins working together in the business. And then, you know, they successfully ran it for the next 25 years and continued to grow it. And within the last, I came into the company about 20 years ago and back in the early 2000s. And then about 7 years ago, I took over as the president CEO after my father retired from the role. And
this explains why you're in an organic chemistry class. This also explains why you would be freaking out about an organic chemistry class. I would never be found dead in the chemistry lab of a college or in the chemistry department of a college or university. Now right. We get why you're there. But it also says, holy smokes, there's a lot on the line for you to perform. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't matter that you're born into the family. You still got to be able to perform for the family.
Yeah.
And if now I'm starting to get a little bit about why you have to work so hard if you're starting in the company in the early 2000s at entry level. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. And you know, I think that I could lay blame or whatever onto, you know, just the pressure of the company. But I would also say that we all have that kind of pressure in one way or another to perform in some way.
It's absolutely true.
And, you know, in my experience, I didn't get a lot of pressure from the family to perform. I mean, there was enough of us and we were large enough. And I would say, you know, now running the business and you know, being the CEO is probably the most stressful, pressure-filled role that you could have because there's so much responsibility on the shoulders. But at the time, really, you know, in the midst of my alcohol, it was primarily just a sense of like what was happening internally to me, you know, and just what I was struggling with. Lots of shame, lots of guilt, lots of you know, just self-fulfilling stuff in the midst of it. Yeah.
Well, I feel like I need to say this out loud. There are people that are listening right now that are struggling just to make ends meet this month, and they don't know if they're going to be able to pay the mortgage next month. And they're sitting there listening, saying, oh, poor Adam, who grew up in this super rich family, and he went through life with a silver spoon. which is definitely not your upbringing. But I think some people struggle. I don't, but I think there are people that struggle to understand the pressure of a legacy. The day before, from the first moments of your childhood, as your earliest memories, you hear about great granddad and all that he accomplished, about your grandparents' generation, your parents' generation, and what they've done. And from an early age, there's pressure on you to perform at that level or beyond. In a family business, that pressure is insane compared to a publicly traded company, for example. I've got a friend who owns a family business. He bought it from his father, but his brothers were part of the business, and he made it very, he came to the realization very early on, there's no way that I can lead this company with my brothers. I'm going to have no choice but to work harder than them, make more money than them, and buy them out. Because in a family business, you have personalities at play too, and every personality has their fingers in the pot. And now you can start to get pulled in 100 different directions. No organization can survive trying to go in 100 directions at once. And that happens in a family business too. So as you're talking, I'm like, man, I can see pressure on top of pressure on top of pressure mounting. And then you make it to the CEO position. And now you still have all of those family pressures and the traditions and the legacies. And mm-hmm. Oh, by the way, you better make the company more money in this generation than the four generations before you did. So
yes.
It never lets up, right?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And it's a great point, is there is a lot of pressure. And a lot of that pressure, especially in a family business, comes from a lack of communication. We talked about community earlier, and if you're in a business, that is a community. You are in that community of that business, and lack of communication, lack of clarity on the expectations, on knowing where the legacy is going, on what to expect, on how that is. I mean, that's a recipe for a lot of stress. It's a recipe for entitlement. And if you don't have those things nailed down, that's probably the most critical thing that a family business, especially a multi-generational family business that has many family members and many personalities working on it.
Heck yeah.
Yeah, you have to have that legacy plan in place. And legacy is not just about transferring wealth or transferring the shares or anything like that. It's also about the communication they have. It's about the structure. It's about the long-term vision. It's about the values. And it's about those values not turning into sacred cows. Those sacred cows can take you down because those become anchors in the business.
Absolutely. Because you live in the Denver area, I'll use this analogy. I try to help people understand the pressures that go along with being in a family business. And when I bring this up sometimes with people that are young leaders stepping into leadership roles, I say, imagine what the conversation is like in the Manning family at Thanksgiving when they're having conversations over the Thanksgiving table, because you've got Archie Manning, you've got Eli and Peyton Manning, and then you've got Cooper Manning's son that's coming along. And yeah, you've got a bunch of NFL royalty in this same home, but the pressure in that house is also insane. I love the Manning guys, and because you're in the Denver area, I'll just throw Peyton Manning's name up there on purpose. But one of the things I love about him is their way to laugh off some of their mistakes and some of their failures, because the kind of pressure in a family legacy like that can frankly overwhelm people. There are people, and you've already mentioned it, who will take their own life because they're not living up to the family name. And the ultimate embarrassment or the ultimate failure is to not live up to my dad or granddad or great granddad's accomplishments. Man, that pressure is what's relentless about it is it's not just work related pressure, right? It's your last name pressure.
Right. It's Thanksgiving dinner. It's all of that. Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, you hear it not just in the business. And even if you say, even if you have a family that is incredibly supportive and they say, we don't expect a lot from, you know, whatever happens,
they say it. They don't really mean it, right?
when it really comes down to it, you know, and even internally, you know, we put that pressure on ourselves.
On ourselves. And
I think that's why if you're running a family, really anybody should be going through therapy should have some confidant that they can talk to who is really trustworthy on
definitely.
That.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. Totally agree. That is the one common denominator. We never even started off this way, but almost every episode of Unbeatable, that comment comes up. Mm-hmm. If you're not already seeing a counselor, if you don't have a therapist, if you don't have somebody who is walking you through your problems, go get them and get one today. There is no excuse why you would turn to the bottle and why the bottle would become your, you know, safety. And it would eventually consume 10 years of your life. But now, at least with a little bit of your family background and the family business, people can start to understand that pressure is relentless. And it's not just to perform at work. It's my last name pressure. So that explains why you're in you're in a jail cell and you're realizing I got to get help. And it's not just, I could have hurt somebody that was innocent and, you know, my alcohol could have hurt somebody really bad, but also I'm letting down a lot of people right now. And a lot of people that are dead and gone I'm letting all of them down as well. Which brings us to the point of the conversation that I really want to hear from you, man. You made a massive life transformation. Listen, some guys and gals don't beat alcoholism. Some guys and gals barely, you know, survive it. And you not only beat it, well, you know, recovering alcoholics will say I never really beat it, but you not only are winning, but you experienced this radical transformation. And I mentioned it becoming like the poster boy, and I'm being almost literal here, with the Ironman championships in Kona. So where did the triathlon come into this equation?
Yeah, I saw my first Ironman triathlon world championship back in 2006 when I was, so doing the math, I was still in the midst of my alcoholism.
I was going to say, you're yes. on the couch with a beer watching it on TV.
How right? did you know? Yeah. Yeah, it was the middle of a Saturday afternoon. Yeah, I saw it come on, and you know, the announcer comes on and shares the distances. He talks about 2.4 miles of swimming, 112 miles of bike,
yeah,
26.2 mile run. And I'm thinking to myself, how many days does that take? And then on cue, he's like, all in one day. And I'm like, it just blew my mind to think that that was possible. So I watched this and I was thinking, okay, this is like crazy, like Olympic Australian people that are, you know, just doing this thing.
Freaks, right?
Right.
Like not human.
Yeah. And if you've ever seen the Ironman World Championship on NBC, the broadcast that happens every year, you'll see that they highlight quote unquote normal people or people who have overcome significant challenges.
Yeah,
and yeah. I watched in that episode as John Blaze, who had ALS, which was Lou Gehrig's disease.
Yeah.
A year later, he would be in a wheelchair watching the race, but he finished the Ironman World Championship while having ALS. I watched the 70-something-year-old Iron Nun, Sister Madonna Booter, cross the finish line. 70-year-old woman. And I watched Dick and Rick Hoyt, father and son duo.
Team Hoyt, yes. I love those. That's the story.
Yeah. So they replayed them doing the finishing in 1989, and it blew me away. And I was just like, I remember this thought process in my mind. My mind just whirled with this like excitement of like, how cool would it be to cross that? How cool would it be to do that? And as quickly as that thought came up, here comes the fear. And it tells me, no way, that's not you, man.
Yeah, that's not for people like you, right? Those people are very different or very special.
Right, yeah. I'm here with a beer in my hand, smoking a cigarette. I'm overweight. I'm not that. I've never even run like more than
I don't even run to the mailbox. How am I going to do this, right?
Yeah, so that thought immediately went out of my mind and I didn't think about it again until I had a year of sobriety. And the reason that year of sobriety was important was because during that first year of recovery, you know, from the point I left the jail cell, walked into my first AA meeting, did 90 meetings in 90 days, and then continued to just go full in, 100% into recovery. I kept on hearing this phrase in my first year: don't make any major life changes your first year in recovery, because you need to focus on recovery. You need to focus on sobriety. It's so important. But because I'm like that A-type personality, I heard that and I internalized it. And I thought to myself, well, then that means I need to make a major life change when I hit a year
at
of sobriety.
At day 366, right. I'm going to make a major life change.
Right.
Even if I don't know what it is and don't want to, I'm going to make one anyway.
Yes. And so I spent like the month leading up to it thinking like, well, what do I want to change? And I ended up at the same time having a shoulder surgery from just like something I screwed up. I don't even know how I screwed it up, but it was a torn labrum and I got that surgery and I was laying in bed at a year of sobriety and thinking of the major life change. And then also looking at the peanut M&Ms resting on my stomach as I was eating away.
Bag of peanut M&M's sitting on my belly.
Yes. And so and it was the perfect like table for it because it was just right up there.
Yeah.
But I thought about it and I was like, well, my physical health, that's what I've been neglecting. I'm still smoking. I got sober, which was something I never thought that I could do. And that statement of like, I never thought that I could do brought me back to that moment and aligned with like the health thing. I'm like, well, wait, I remember that time when I said that I could never do an Ironman World Championship either. And at that moment, when I thought about it, the same feelings erupted as they did, you know, 10 years or however many years earlier that was, 6 years earlier. The excitement rose up and all of these thoughts came up. And at the same time, that fear rose up and said, no, that's not you. Look at you eating peanut M&Ms. Look at you still smoking cigarettes. Look at, you know, that's not you. But this perspective shifted because of all of that time I spent in that community that was helping me heal, that was helping me to grow out of that, that was helping me to transform in that way. This was not the transformative moment. The transformative moment came a year earlier when I started to actually make the decision to go into recovery. Right. But I decided at that moment, I'm going to do an Ironman triathlon. And I don't want to just do that one. I want to qualify for the one I saw on television. I want to do the Ironman World Championship.
I want to go to the championships in Kona, Hawaii.
Yeah. And so that was the commitment I made without ever having ridden a road bike in my life, without ever having swim more than the length of a pool at a time. I signed up for my first Ironman in Cabo San Lucas, which was going to happen a year later. And I decided to build the parachute on the way down after jumping out of the plane. So I worked that year and I ended up, you know, just working in the same way and finished my first Ironman triathlon in March of 2014, which was with a little over 2 years sober.
Hold on. Let me get the math on or the timing on this right. You're sitting there watching it on TV and you're set with a beer and a cigarette and you're saying, I'd love to do that, but that's not me. I don't have that ability. A year later, you're sitting there with a bag of peanut M&Ms on your belly saying, you know what? I'm going to do this. Do you go out right away and just sign up for a triathlon? Is that what you do next?
I did. I did a little research first. I said like, well, how do the first thing I wanted to do was,
what do I got to do to get in to start this thing?
Yeah. Right? How do I sign up for the Ironman World Championship? Oh, you don't, you have to qualify. Oh, how do I qualify? And then you kind of work down the path and it's like, all right, what race is best for me? I'm like, well, okay. Cabo San Lucas happens about a year from now. I'm reading the things that, you know, I've heard from people that it takes, you know, about a year to become an Ironman triathlete if you work really hard. And so I gave myself the ultimate accountability and put the money down to sign up for the race. And then I reached out to, you know, Mark Allen, who was a coach and a former Ironman triathlete, world championship triathlete, and started getting some coaching from his coaching platform. And that started the ball rolling.
I love that because there are some people that are probably sitting there listening to this episode right now with a bag of peanut M&Ms on their belly. And they're saying, I would love to do something. And what I want them to hear is what you did is you just did a little research, signed up for it. And then the motivation became, well, I put my name down and I've already put some money down. Now I got to figure out how to do this thing. And everyone that I've ever met who's done something like you're describing realizes early into it, holy moly, what did I just sign up for? This is far, far more difficult than I thought, but I've signed up for it.
Yeah.
I'm going to do it and I'm going to keep at it.
Yeah. Well, that,
by the way, real quickly, this episode airs the night before the Olympics start. And I've said this on a previous episode or two. I am an Olympics junkie. I will watch every single event, even the equestrian events with the horses. I hate all of that stuff, but I'll watch almost every event of the Olympics for the very reason that you're describing. It's the human aspect stories behind the Olympic event that I'm fascinated by. The people and all that they have overcome, all that they've given up, all that they've committed and what they've had to sacrifice to get there. Man, I can watch just about any Olympic event and be on the edge of my seat because I'm thinking about, like you, what it's taken to be able to get to there, get there, even if they don't end up on the platform with a gold, silver, or bronze medal around their neck. Just the sacrifices they were willing to make and the obstacles they overcame to get there. Man, I am the biggest fan on the planet of the Olympics because of the human aspect stories behind the scenes.
Yeah, that's such a great, me too. And as you say that, I remember that I used to watch those as a kid and be totally inspired by that. And I remembered I watched Apollo Anton Ono. Do you remember who
the speed skater?
Yeah. I remember watching him when I was younger, maybe in my teens or so, when he was winning the Olympics and seeing his personal story. And interestingly enough, the first year I got into triathlon was the first year he got into triathlon. And really? We ended up meeting each other a couple of times.
Tell me that you guys were running or you were cycling together. This is awesome.
I did not do the race, the world championship the same year he did, but I did race in a few of the same events down in Carlsbad, up in Boise, Idaho.
So obviously from the first event in Cabo San Lucas, you eventually stick with it. If you end up making it to the world championships at Kona, can you give us a little taste of the progression all the way up to Kona, Hawaii?
Yeah. And I think this is an important point for people too, is, you know, you have this moment of excitement and fear rising up. And in my opinion, that's your signal that you need to go follow it. If you have excitement and fear rising up in equal measure, because that's like a signal that you're pushing beyond your comfort zone.
You have these two in combination, excitement and fear.
Yeah. And so I think it's important to note though, that it took, I qualified at my 7th Ironman triathlon. So my goal was to qualify for the Ironman World Championship. So I could say to myself that I failed 6 times before I succeeded, you know, and I would have failed more, because I enjoyed the process and I learned so much every single time. But it was, it took me 6 tries and over time they eventually got better. And I realized that after my first triathlon, and I trained with so much discipline over that first year, that I finished in the top 30% of the field, which put me.
With 1 year of practice, I'm very impressed.
Thank you. But I realized that the people that were qualifying at that race were about 10% faster than I did. So there was this idea that, okay, so I need to find 10% improvement. Where do I find that 10% improvement? And it was the little tweaks, there's a lot of things that you have the point of diminishing returns where you have to have an enormous amount of effort to make it. But it really is in those cases where you need 10% improvement over time, it's little tweaks day by day. So it was a sense of, okay, well, I did my speed work on Friday. What if I introduced this? What if I changed this about my nutrition strategy? What if I changed this? Just tweaking everything over time and having an absolute focus over it. So over the course of time, I started to get a little better. And then in 2017, I ended up seeing this casting call for a reality TV show that was called Iron Man Quest for Kona. And it hit me like a ton of bricks that, well, what if I were to try to be on this show and qualify for it?
What if I show the whole world, that I'm not able to make it, but I'm sure going to try.
I put myself out there. I put myself at risk. Yeah, but if I succeed,
definitely.
Here's a guy that once saw the Ironman World Championship with a beer in his hand and a cigarette in his mouth thinking he could never do it. And now appearing on a television show doing the very thing he said he could never do. What if I did that?
That ranches up the pressure just a little bit.
But I ended up applying and I ended up getting accepted to it. And I over the course of that training program, I ended up training for it and getting to the race. Cameraman was following me the entire race. I ended up getting third, wow, third in my age group, which qualified me out of, about 300 people. And it was, and so I ended up qualifying for the Ironman World Championship, and I did it on deep cable on a Wednesday afternoon, but I did it on national television.
Wow. Yeah. Man, talk about shifting gears. And by this, I mean cigarette and a beer, bag of peanut M&Ms, to actually being able to show up to the starting line of Kona. I know that this is almost impossible to put into words, but can you describe for people what it feels like when you cross that finish line in Kona and you hear that famous announcer say, Adam Hill, you are an Ironman?
It was a dream come true. I mean, when you're spending 10 and a half hours, achieving your, basically running your dream, you know,
at you're about 100% physical ability, 100% of your physical endurance.
Yeah. Right? And so, I mean, even leading up to crossing the finish line, just entering into the transition area in that morning when it's still dark, helicopters flying around, seeing the iconic sights, putting your bike on the bike rack that is on the pier in Kona next to Sebastian Kienle and all of these professional triathletes. I was racked next to where Julie Moss, who's a professional triathlete, and where Team Hoyt was going to be racked as well, but they ended up not coming. But just to be racked next to my idols was incredible. Cool. And then crossing the finish line was just like, I remember, pieces of it, because it's just like, you're so tired, you're so exhausted. And I remember crossing the finish line and giving the fist bump and feeling this immense like excitement. And it lasted like 15 seconds. And then I was like, okay, I need pizza. You know, that was the next thought. But that was an interesting point, though. It's like, you know, the journey leading up to an achievement that you want so bad, you get to it, you achieve it. And it's a moment of celebration. But then it's, if you are an achiever, it's like, well, what's next? What am I going after? What is next? If your growth mindset, you have to lean into the growth.
One of the biggest disappointments of my life is the day after finishing and winning the Best Ranger competition. I wake up the next morning and I say, I have spent the last 4 years of my life almost every day towards this moment. What the heck do I do today?
Yeah.
I don't know what to do with my life now, because I've come out on top and I got to figure out what I do next. What I want to talk about for the next few moments is about overcoming fear. Because ultimately, the Unbeatable podcast is just stories of everyday, ordinary people that have faced some extraordinary circumstances. And then most people, when they've been punched in the face by life, like you and others that I've interviewed, most people will just lay down and throw up their hands and quit and say, that's it, I'm done. You know, there's nothing left in me. But the guests that I have the honor of talking to, they're the ones that somehow dig deep. They find it in them to overcome the fear and to get back up, even though they've just been punched hard in the face by life, and get back in there. And I have two real passions in life. One of my passions is leadership. You know more than a few things about that. The other passion is about courage in the face of fear. Mm-hmm. And you're both of those wrapped up in one guy. So let's spend a few moments now helping people who may never try to do an Ironman triathlon. They may never have the desire to lead a business and become the CEO, president of a corporation, but are facing some hard things in life. And deep inside, there's this little small voice that says, either you're not good enough, or that hurts so much that we don't ever want to go through that again. So why don't you just stay down and surrender and quit in the face of difficulties instead of being unbeatable and overcoming them? You've kind of written the book on overcoming fear. So Adam, let's talk about how you do this. How do you advise other people that are facing some really scary stuff? What do you say to them?
Yeah, it's a great question. And there's a lot of nuance to how we experience fear. And I think the most important thing that we should recognize first. And one thing that I neglected early on, which led to alcoholism and all of this stuff, was that it's going to exist. And it's a very important feeling and something that we should embrace as an important signal for us, something that we should embrace as a feeling and work through and give ourselves a little grace around it. Because
I want to clarify, yeah. When you say embrace, you're saying embrace the fact that I am really scared right now.
Yes.
And it's okay to admit that I'm really scared right now.
Yes, absolutely. Because okay. I will tell you, I am still that scared, anxious boy that was, you know, that grew up. I still have that level of anxiety. It's still with me. And what I've learned to do within my life is instead of trying to suppress it or push it down, in which case it wants to get stronger, it fights back, it pushes back with all its might. Instead of pushing it down, you know, let it come up, learn to ask it questions, get curious about it, find out what it's trying to tell you. Because the fact that we feel it more intensely than others in a lot of cases, you know, that is, it's painful, it hurts, it's uncomfortable, but it's also in a lot of ways a superpower. And I know that sounds a little trite, but but the fact that we're feeling it to a degree, or I feel anxiety to a degree that it's elevated, it's still a signal for me that there's something that I need to pay attention to. And a lot of times, if that fear is accompanied by excitement, it might be something that I need to go after that's going to make my life better. Because it, historically speaking, 100% of the time, when I chase something that scares me, that's exciting, it leads to growth. Either I fail and I grow, or I succeed and I grow.
Sure, totally.
Or it's telling me that I have something to genuinely be scared about if that excitement isn't there. And maybe I should pay attention to that. Maybe I should listen to it and step back or ask the right questions or run away from the bear cave or do whatever I need to do that's facing that fear.
The bear cave. Love that quote.
But, but instead of, I mean, I think that's the first and most important thing is instead of trying to suppress it, let's try to learn what it's telling us. And if it is truly debilitating, it can be very debilitating. We all have that, those experiences in our lives where it is impacting our lives. It's just too uncomfortable. It's too much for us. Know that there are people around us. There is a community somewhere that can help us through what we're going through, whatever it is specifically. If it's alcoholism, there's communities of sobriety. If it's just a general anxiety disorder, there are therapists and counselors that can help through that. If it's terror, if it's PTSD over something that you're experiencing, same thing. There are counselors or there are support groups. Yeah. There are people that have gone through it. And, you know, thank God we're not stigmatizing it as much as we were in the past.
Absolutely.
And there's help available. So that's my best.
Okay. So I, what I heard you say is step one is to just admit out loud. I added the phrase out loud. You didn't, but admit out loud that this is scary. And I think there are some people, there's this lady who's trying to make it in a man's world, and she doesn't want to have to admit out loud because it's going to make her look weak. There's this guy who wants to be known as the tough guy, and he gives off the persona that I'm never afraid of anything. And anybody who's honest with themselves would say that's a lie. There's no human that's completely impervious to fear. But I'm sitting there dissecting this in my mind, thinking to myself, okay, if step one is just admitting it, then there's a couple of ways that we can fail ourselves here when it comes to overcoming fear. And the first is to never be willing to even admit that I'm afraid, to play it off or to act like it's no big deal, even though inside you know that it is a big deal, because part of admitting it means helping to find a community that can help you through it. But it also sounds to me like there is a percentage of people that say, I know that being in that situation is scary, so I'll never allow myself to get into that situation so that I cannot be scared. Mm-hmm. And that means you never even get a chance to get to step one. You have no ability to ever find out what you're capable of because you didn't allow yourself to get into a scary situation and see what your possible, what your capabilities are.
Yeah.
And I think this is where a lot of people live their lives today.
Yeah.
They live their lives insulated from a situation that can get scary. And unfortunately, they'll never be able to show up at Cabo San Lucas in the first place,
right?
Because they put themselves in a position where I just won't even be in a situation where I can get scared. That way I never have to overcome it.
Yeah.
What would you say to people like that?
Yeah, I would say that just as we can, that fear is elastic and you have to keep stretching it, right? So if you just as you can go to the starting line of a race or whatever your Ironman might be and push past your fear and comfortably expand that your comfort level, so too can your comfort level be compressed upon you if you try to escape fear or if you try to suppress it, or if you push it back. The fear finds you. And if you're not going to constantly be pushing against it and questioning it or pushing it outward a little bit at a time. And it doesn't have to be a lot. If you're afraid of heights, don't jump out of an airplane right now. You know, maybe climb 6-foot ladder or something, right? But just pushing a little bit, pushing the edges of that comfort zone a little bit at a time expands the elasticity. But if you're not doing that, it becomes brittle and then your world becomes very small.
Yeah.
So just keep that in mind.
Yeah, you face a little bit of fear today, and that gives you the ability to face a little bit more fear tomorrow, which gives you a little bit more capacity to face fear the next day.
Right.
And then pretty soon, a year from now, 10 years from now, you're looking back at yourself saying, wow, where the heck did this come from? I never expected that I could handle some of the challenges that I'm going through.
Yeah. When I was first going through that first year of Ironman training, I was terrified of open water swimming and I'd never done it before. Really? I never swam past a buoy, right? So I couldn't just start swimming 2.4 miles in the open ocean.
Just don't jump out in the middle of the Pacific right, with a wetsuit on.
Yeah. And if I thought about that all the time, it would have prevented me from doing it. But the first step is like, all right, maybe I'm just going to swim 200 yards out there today. I'm going to swim along the shoreline today. And that's all I'm expecting of myself. And then tomorrow we'll look at it next day. One day at a time, expand that comfort zone.
I never really heard somebody use the idea of the elasticity of fear, which means if you're willing to push back against fear just a little bit today and a little bit more tomorrow and more the next day, you can broaden your capacity to deal with fear. But I am 100% in agreement with what you just said, Adam. Fear will find you. So if you just decide, I'm not going to put myself in those circumstances because I'm afraid of how it's going to turn out and it might hurt or I might get embarrassed or I may let people down, fear is going to find you anyway. So really what we're saying in this episode is you don't have a choice. It's either going to find you or you can push against it. But either way, you're going to deal with it. Everybody's going to deal with it. And we're all going to deal with it all the time.
Yes.
So why don't you just broaden your capacity to deal with it?
Yeah. And in the process, you build a relationship with it. And even if it's not comfortable, it's fulfilling. And it's giving you
build
a signal
a
to where you grow.
Relationship with fear. Yeah. I'm writing this. Man, I'm writing down a lot of quotes from you today, man. Build a relationship with fear. A healthy relationship with fear.
Yes.
Not an unhealthy paranoia of it, but build a healthy relationship with fear.
Mm-hmm.
You have had to face more than a few fears in life, not just, physically, but you've also faced some fears professionally. You have helped transition a family-owned business, and you've helped your business go through some significant changes. And I'll just spoil the story, but you've done it very successfully and helped lead a company from 8 figures to 9 figures. But man, just dealing with change, let alone leading a family-owned company through change, is a very scary activity. So you had to pick up a few principles in life just leading the company through change. Can you describe a few of those?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, especially as it relates to family business. I think when it comes to really any kind of growth, but especially in business and leaning through that fear, system, structure, and communication are vitally important. And the reason I say that is structure defines, it's the bones of an organization. It's going to define how well you're able to operate in any area. So know the roles that you need and know those roles before you fill them with people. And this is especially true for family businesses putting the personalities aside, if you are looking first at the roles you want to fill, then you can look at the people and say, well, where best do they fit? So you get the right people in the right seats instead of creating a position for Cousin John that isn't going to add any value unless he like
and
really works for
Cousin John miserable as well as hurt the family and the business. 100%.
Yeah. And give yourself a lot of anxiety and fear because now you've kind of stained that relationship a little bit. And then it's the system. What operating system are you using within your business? Like we implemented EOS, Entrepreneurial Operating System, about 3 years ago, and it was a game changer for us. Not necessarily because, because EOS is a very successful operating system, but more than that, it was just we put in a system for how we wanted to operate, for how we wanted to communicate. So it kept us in touch and all that kind of stuff. The importance of a system, especially in a family business, is for a leader in a business who's a family member who's got the weight of 60
Thanksgiving dinner on the line. This isn't absolutely about stock or shareholders. This is about Thanksgiving dinner on the line here.
Yes. If you can have a system that takes some of the weight of the responsibility of decision making off of your shoulders, well, then you have some more capacity to make those decisions with more courage because you have that support and you can always. Say, this is what the system says, and we're running on that with discipline. So systems are very important on that front. I think that also having outside facilitators to help you run those systems is important. And then finally, communication, honesty. I mean, even if it's hard conversations, especially if it's hard conversations, we never want to have them. And I know everybody knows this, have the hard conversations, because if you're not, it's going to sit in your mind. It's going to cause a lot of that fear. If you're not leaning into those hard conversations that you need to have with love, not with fear, but with love, then you're just pushing down that thing that's scaring you again. And that just goes against what we talked about earlier.
Yeah. You have personally shifted gears now. I keep using the title of your book, man. Let's just talk about your book for a second.
Sure.
I'll we'll talk about the way that you've shifted gears. There it is right there. Yeah. So you released a book in 2022 that just helps people see, listen, I'm a regular guy who's been able to overcome some anxiety and addiction and been able to thrive on the other side of it. Tell everybody about the book, where they can find the book. And by the way, at the end of this episode, for those of you that are driving, we're going to give away a free copy of the book, but just tell everybody about the book for a moment.
Yeah. And thank you for that. You can find it on Amazon. It's called Shifting Gears from Anxiety and Addiction to a Triathlon World Championship. And make sure and type my name in there too, if you're searching for it, because there's other Shifting Gears titles that you may not want to see. And I didn't really anticipate that when I picked the title.
Okay. So maybe there's a not safe for work title out there. You might want to make sure you include Adam Hill next to when you're typing it in.
Yes. And so you can find it on Amazon. You can also find it on Audible if you want to hear me narrate the story with my droning on voice. But it's really about my journey, which we just kind of summarized here. And I go into greater detail on some of the aspects of the training that I did, some of the aspects of how I experienced alcoholism and how the recovery process went. So it's just greater detail on some of the lessons learned in my life on how I went from being just anxious and in that really, really small life where I was confined by fear to a very expansive life where I've built a relationship with it and been able to experience some really amazing things beyond the bounds of it.
Well, thanks. I asked you to do that right here on purpose because I want people to hear that you shifted gears or are in the process of shifting gears personally. Mm-hmm. Although you're still the president and CEO of the Hill Brother Chemical Company, a family-owned company for more than 100 years, you're now helping other people lead family-owned companies. And I've tried to stress a couple of times during this interview with you, there is some dynamics about family-owned companies that most people will never understand unless they've been around those circles. You don't have to work for a company like that, but you got to be around those circles to see some of those dynamics are powerful and overwhelming. So now you're consulting a little bit, if I understand correctly. What brought on this shift personally and professionally?
Yeah, and I think it really comes from how I experienced something that I thought would be one of the pinnacles of my life. And I think for many of us who might be in a family business, we think of the day we might start to run it, and then things go golden because, you know, everything works out great when that moment happens, right? But when I went into that role, I think I experienced some of the greatest fear that I've ever experienced in my life.
Wow.
And yeah. And some of the greatest stresses. And I've also seen in that process, you know, how lonely it can be, how relationships change. Yeah.
And, oh, yeah. 100%.
And yep. And I just want to be able to, I want to be a service and a value to other next generation people that are coming in that need to have those hard conversations, that need to put those systems in place, that want to find the right structure and really lead into and form their identity for the next generation and build a company that's going to last for generations down the line. So if there's any interest in that, I'm happy to chat with anybody. It's something I'm at the very beginning stages of. So I'm just happy to chat and learn from anybody that might be having some issues.
Well, just people getting together that are experiencing the same kind of pressures at the same levels of an organization. Mm-hmm. And I'm convinced everybody needs that at every level, but especially when you're at the top. Because when you're at the top, you're making decisions for people's livelihoods. You're making decisions for the legacy of the company. You're making decisions that are going to impact generations to come. And there's not a lot of people that you could spill your guts to about those decisions, unless they're doing the same thing at another company that's not a competitor of yours, right? And now you have two people that are saying, oh, really? You're going through this? I am too? How do you handle it? And here's how I'm handling it. And man, that becomes priceless, really, at the level that you're at right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Are you, do people find you? Are you finding people? Like, how do those relationships develop for you?
Yeah, I'm part of a variety of different communities, as we talk about that main theme of community. So I'm part of a mastermind group that I really enjoy, and part of a variety of family business councils across the Western states that, you know, I connect with, and again, part of the building into the EOS community as well is always been valuable. So, yeah.
Well, man, listen, thank you for giving me about 30 one-liners that I'm going to take away from this conversation. Again, I said at the beginning, you're a busy guy with a lot on your plate, and now people can hear that you've given up a lot. You have a lot on your plate to give up some time for this interview. But more than anything else, man, thank you for just being raw and honest about how you faced fears, how you've learned to overcome them. And maybe somebody who's listening today has learned to, gotten the courage to get up tomorrow and to face one of their fears.
Now, Jeff, it's been my honor. Thank you so much for just giving me the platform and the opportunity to share the story.
Sounds good. I'll be thinking about you when I watch the opening ceremony of the Olympics. Like, I don't know if Adam is watching this, but I'm watching this.
Heck right yeah.
Now. Thanks, man.
Thank you.
We'll see you around.
Bye.
I hope you heard something from Adam today that's going to stick with you like it's going to stick with me. And maybe you're struggling with some fears. Maybe what you need to do this week is just do step one that Adam described. Just be willing to embrace the fear and admit the fear. And perhaps admit it out loud to some trusted friends or to your community. And to just let people know, hey, I'm scared about what I'm about to face. Will you just hang with me? Will you just be a voice that I can talk to about what I'm getting ready to go through? There are some people out there that are amazing people that are open and honest and sharing what's going on in their world. They're staying connected with each other. They're staying connected with this podcast. You can find them out there on social media. If you just search for @unbeatablepodcast, you'll find some pretty incredible people that may be able to become your community one day. Maybe you'll find a guy out there like Jake Preston. Because Jake, you are our unbeatable fan of the week this week. And we just want to say thank you for being part of the big community of podcast listeners for the Unbeatable Podcast. If you really want to go deep and become part of this community, you got to join the Unbeatable Army. It's totally free. All you do is go over to unbeatablearmy.com. And by the way, I've got some freebies there for the people that are that committed and that connected to us.
But for one person that's part of the Unbeatable Army, you don't even have to sign up for anything. For one person that's part of the Unbeatable Army, we're going to give away a free copy of Adam's book, Shifting Gears. If you're driving when you listen to this episode and you missed that title, we'll put the link to the book and the title in the notes to this episode. But for somebody who's already part of the Unbeatable Army, we're going to give away a free copy of that book. So if you want to become part of the Unbeatable Army, if you want to be registered, all you got to do is be on the email list and you're already registered for Adam's book, Shifting Gears. Adam, thank you again for taking your time. Thank you for getting real with us about your struggles and about your successes. And I hope you've heard something today from Adam that is going to stick with you the rest of this week. I'll see you right back here next week with another amazing guest. See you around. God bless.
These stories of triumph over adversity will help you handle your toughest days in life and become unbeatable.